Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Any sparring session, which these guys do, there's always a physio present. There's always a medical person present. Why? Because we are there just in case anything happens, you know, as you would have, hopefully, in training scenarios, anyway, in football. But also is to have that eye, that when you're speaking with the coach, you can sort of speak about things. And if anything happens, they'll speak to you, and you can, you know, cross-reference around that. So, no, I'd say that the prevalence of concussion isn't as high as when you compare it to other sports. You know, I look at sports like rugby and football sometimes, and I think, like, you know what? I'm glad I work in boxing because it's more controlled.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Late Fitness Test. I'm your host, Stel, and my two co-hosts are, as ever, Mr. Ben Dinnery and Johnny Wilson. Ben Dinnery, how are you doing, my friend? You missed last week. Where were you?
Well, I was tucking into a takeaway. You know, I hold my hands up, cannot lie.
Anton Dex takeaway or?
The Chinese. I just smashed the Chinese all over the place and watched. I'm well into The Last Dance at the moment. So I think I'm up to episode 7. So last week's pod was a little bit late in the evening for me good self. And I was bushed. I had to just do the dirty deed and bow up to that one.
Shall I give you a spoiler?
So my apologies for that.
Shall I give you a little bit of a spoiler? Chicago Bulls have done fuck all since Jordan left.
how do you replace that man? It's impossible.
LeBron James. Anyway, Johnny Wilson, how you doing?
The Last Dance is one of the best series I've ever watched. I'm just gutted that I'm finished all the episodes, and I can't believe it gets to 10 and you just want another episode and another episode and another episode. It was just epic. So if anybody hasn't watched The Last Dance on Netflix, oh man, yeah, it's crazy. And it just, in the dressing room and the way Michael Jordan was in that, it is so true. Everything that happens in there is just extraordinary. And it is what happens, and, you know, coming right down to the mechanics of between the chief executives and the owners and the manager and the players and who's running the dressing room, and just some of the stuff that he said in each series, just little stuff like saying to somebody, you're barred from talking to him, you can't talk to him tonight because you'll scare the shit out of him, you know, he was talking about somebody talking to a player, and it was incredible. So if you haven't watched it, guys, oh my god, you know, you're just going to get sucked in there. Brilliant show.
Is there anybody in the world who hasn't actually watched it?
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we introduce our guest and ask him? All right, well, without further ado, our special guest is a gentleman who, well, boxing expert. He's the head of performance services at GB Boxing. Blimey, he's done a hell of a lot of stuff, and he's the physio for some bloke that's been a unified champion twice, so I won't mention his name. Anthony Joshua's physio. It's Ian Gatt. How you doing, Ian?
I'm all right, mate. I'm all right, yes. Of course I've seen The Last Dance, and also I've seen Space Jam.
Yes.
That's like the sequel.
Oh, classic. Absolute classic.
I haven't seen that one. I haven't seen Space Jam.
Oh, there's another one coming out next year also, Space Jam 2.
That's right. There you go. But the thing is, yeah, from what I've heard, a lot of people have been very, skeptical about this Last Dance show, because apparently it painted Michael Jordan in a very, very good light, when some claim that he wasn't this really, really nice guy. But you're going to get haters everywhere, aren't you?
Yeah, but you know,
he didn't I was going to say
the one thing we have to always remember is that, you know, what's being depicted happened quite a few years ago, and then we use the brains we have today with the current knowledge to then look back and criticize what happened back there. It's almost like thinking like what happened in the 1500s and what happened, you know, in the barbaric times. It's like it's hard, really, because when you are in that period, it is a complete different period to what we are now, and it's very hard to criticize, in my opinion.
I think he came across as a bully, Stel. I don't think they depicted him as a very nice guy. I think he even knows that himself, that, you know, that people were saying that he was ruling the dress room. He came across as a bully, and it was all about him. I don't think they depicted him in any good light. I think
But Johnny, don't forget that there were parts in it where Jordan was saying, oh, well, you know, I've got my own standards, and if these people don't want to reach these standards, then they shouldn't be here. This is showing a form of leadership, some kind of, you know, Zeus-like character, you know?
I think that's what he was. He was a bully. He was like, I'm going to drag this dressing room to be what it is. And without Michael Jordan there being that bully and that type of personality, and he knows, he was asked the question in the series, would it have been better to just be liked by everybody or go and win championships? And he was like, bro, I need to win games. I need to, you know, I want to be the best player here. And any time there was anybody who was an MVP, it was a case of, nah, I'm putting you back down in your box. And I am going to bully you. And he was bullying his own teammates to be better and all that. I don't see that The Last Dance depicted him as any other way than what he was. And I think he should be okay with that. And everybody else should be okay with that. And then you can either live with it or you can't. What did you think, Ben?
I agree with you, Johnny. I was quite surprised to see that side of him. It's something that I had never read about or seen, or certainly something that wasn't widely publicised before I seen The Last Dance. And yeah, he, the relationship with his teammates, dragged him up, and you know, make no bones about it, he was the alpha dog of the pride, and he's, you know, quite rightly so. I mean, the guy is superhuman, and yeah, I think he's in a position where he can command that level of respect. I don't think there's many other sportsmen in the world who are able to maybe strike that level of dominance within a change room. He's just, yeah, you know, I came away from that thinking, well, yeah, maybe, no, Michael Jordan isn't as squeaky clean as maybe once thought he was.
But come on, he was a winner, man. And without him, look what happened.
Oh, hey, I tell you what, respect the guy. He'd done what he'd done because, you know, he was focused on doing one thing, and that was taking the Bulls to the championship and succeeded. So, you know, like you say, anybody that's got an issue with that, well, you know, look at the record. And
there you go. There you go.
I suppose it's a balance, though, because, like, do you sacrifice the well-being of the people around you for the common goal, which is the medal, which is the winning, or it's all about that? And that's the questions we have to pose ourselves also in Olympic sports, and probably even the same in football, as I'd imagine. Is like, yes, you're right. You know, he had that winning mentality, and you can't dispute it, and that's what he was for. But did he drag his team to be where they were, or did the team follow him? You see what I mean?
A weak dressing room has never won anything. You look at Manchester United. I'm not a Man United fan. I don't really follow any team at all. But when they were in their pomp, when they were aggressive, when they were leaders, they had a very strong dressing room, guys who just were going, you will fucking win, you will do this, you will do that, this is what we expect from you, and that is it, and this is the Man United way. And that, you know, you have to have that in a dressing room. And sometimes, now again, this is just my opinion here, which means nothing, by the way, you know, but sometimes that common goal has to be the common goal of everybody. And I don't know of anything that is worth anything in life that doesn't come out without a sacrifice. And some people might not be able to make as much a sacrifice as another person, and therefore it might not be the goal for them. But anything that's worth anything, I think you have to, sacrifice has to be your best friend. You've got to hold hands with it, you've got to embrace it, and you've got to go, fuck, I got sacrifice.
You know what, Johnny, I agree with you. Some people are passengers and some people are drivers, and that's the difference.
I agreed.
Sorry, my mute just didn't want to unmute. Fucking hell. I was pressing it frantically like an idiot.
You know what happens a lot in our team meetings? Sometimes somebody forgets to press on mute and they're just talking like a mime.
I was beating it, wasn't working. There you go. Right, so Ian, tell us a little bit about yourself, because I could tell by your accent, you're a foreigner like me.
Yeah, I'm a foreigner. I come from the beautiful island of Malta.
Ah, very nice.
Very sunny Mediterranean island. Probably left there about 20 years ago. Went via Greece for about 5 years around the Athens Olympics, so 2004. Okay. So followed a bit more on sunshine, and then I hit the rainy weathers of the UK. But no, then I probably arrived about 2005, so, you know, a good 15 years ago in the UK, and have been around particularly the Olympic sports and some of the other professional sports in this country. And, you know, my life has always been sports, really. You know, since I've been a physio for the last 20 years, I've always been in sports.
So tell me a little bit about your experience in 2004, because Athens, it was a big deal. I remember being in Cyprus in 2004, just after Greece won the Euros, and then obviously the Olympics are out in Athens, and it's the spiritual home of the Olympics. So what was the atmosphere like there?
Oh, it was amazing, really, because, you know, those were the golden years of sports. You know, the economy was thriving. You know, 2004, you said they had the Euro, which they won, the first game against Portugal, incredibly, and then the second and final against Portugal. So, you know, they really, you know, they were saying that the gods really were looking the other way, where usually they would look at them and almost make them lose. But then, you know, they won the Euro basketball, they had the Olympics. You know, it was like such great years. So for me, you know, it was privilege, because I was there since 2000, so literally that was my first home Olympics. And so when I had my my second home Olympics, which was in London 2012, it was great, because the second time I had a home Olympics, and although I was foreign in the two times, twice I was in that running up period of preparation.
Wow, brilliant, brilliant. Well, we didn't do the clean sweep in 2004, because I think Turkey won the Eurovision, but but yeah. So Malta, by the way, the Azure window, you know what happened with that, right?
Say again, sorry?
The Azure window.
Oh yeah, I know. Yeah. I know. Yeah, unfortunately, what? The gods decided that it was time for it to go.
Do you know what? I remember showing my daughter some landmarks as part of a history lesson for school and geography and all that. And she's only six, and she saw what happened to the Azure window. She started crying. What are you crying about? It's not there anymore. I said, you've never been. But I wanted to go. I said, this is the first time you've seen it. What are you talking about?
Well, I remember I was a kid. You know, we went on it, like probably any person who's probably my age in Malta has probably gone on it. And to be honest, that's probably been one of its downfalls. You know, erosion of time, people going on it, like anything else. You know, when things are not protected, you know, nature just claims its back. So it's probably just a normal occasion for nature. But yeah, I know it was a big thing for Malta when it happened, really.
But I've heard they're going to be rebuilding it. And making it into a restaurant or a museum, sorry?
Yeah, well, yeah, there's always lots of things about considerations what to do, but it's like anything else. Like, you know, when something like that goes, that was a natural thing. So no matter how you you look at it, if they do recreate it, it'll be a man-made. So it takes away something that was probably like millennia of erosion over time. And, you know, when somebody had told me, I didn't even realize that somebody had told me like, was it a couple of years ago now? And I said like, yeah, well, I remember going on it. But it's like, time passes, is it? It's like anything that happens. It's like you always have to remember the fond memories at the time, because you never know what will happen.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, Johnny, get your question in.
Right. Well, I think every physio in the world would want to ask this question. So I'm going to change it up to what I normally do. And the first question is, so Ian, what's it like working with Andy Joshua?
You know what? I actually started working with AJ in 2010 when he joined the GB program. So, you know, think about it. I've been now working with him for the last decade. Nothing really has changed about from obviously the notoriety, I'd say. Like, you know, working with him is the same, you know, same body. A lot of the team that worked with him back then were still the same, you know, so there's a close team that still works with him, which was the same back then. So the only difference now is that obviously you have bigger arenas, you have obviously bigger attention towards him, and like anything else, you know, you have to look after him like any other athlete. I think from a personal point of view, maybe there was a privilege that I was in his corner in the last two fights, and so from just doing the your clinical physio exposure, same as you would have in football, somebody running on the pitch, so you're pitch side, I was ringside, which is obviously, it's a big responsibility when you're part of an entourage of coaches, and your main job is to make sure that this guy can continue this million and million and million worth of pounds of a fight. So, you know, little responsibility over there.
Okay.
Sorry, Ian. So I was just going to say, if you were ringside for the last two fights, does that include the Andy Ruiz Jr. first fight?
Yes, I was in America also.
Ah, you were. So one of the things, obviously, was quite controversial that came out after the fight. Obviously, AJ lost that one knockout in the seventh. But Rob McCracken came out, the trainer, and I don't know if this was a little bit of a bravado or paper talk, but he actually admitted or said that AJ was concussed from the third round, and he knew this, but he said he knew AJ better than anybody else, and he wanted him to continue within the fight, although he was monitoring the situation round by round. So obviously, you know, I mean, is that fact? Is that what happened? And what sort of decision goes, you know, is taken at that stage to, you know, to allow AJ to continue, you know, potentially with the fight, and maybe, you know, putting him at severe risk of a second, you know, concussion.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, like anything else, the risk of the athlete is always weighed, and you've got the eye of a coach is really trained. I mean, the reason he said that, you have to remember that, you know, a coach is not a medical person. You know, when you say concussed and when I say concussed, it means different things. Obviously, what he meant was he didn't look quite right. The guy got hit at the side of the temple, and he wasn't in the best performance that he was continuing the other rounds. He was actually recovering. He was looking quite good in the later rounds. And then, as you know, he wasn't actually knocked out. It was a TKO. So TKO is a technical knockout, meaning that the referee stops it. So, you know, which is different. You know, if somebody gets knocked out, completely sparked out, which we know, again, doesn't necessarily indicate concussion, you know, it's a head injury, because we know that you have more concussions with less knockouts than you would have. Then in that situation, what he was doing, just monitoring it, and again, we were speaking in the corner and having an eye on him. Now, you have to imagine that we've seen AJ in sparring, we've seen AJ in competitions, so you know when somebody is either deteriorating or improving. And the other thing you have to remember is you can't compare one sport to another. So, you know, we're still learning about what does concussion really mean. You know, there's a group in Buffalo that have created their own terms. There is, you know, the consensus statements that sometimes are done every 4 years, which sometimes conflict a little bit what other groups are saying. So, you know, when we use the word concussion, it means something different to completely different people. We still don't know what the real entirety of the diagnosis and the full spray of symptoms and what it means and full recovery means. You know, there's lots of research still coming out to indicate what, you know, full breadth of symptoms are, when should you actually recover. You know, some studies now are talking about, you know, even though all the symptoms look good, you maybe not be good in 30 days after from a physiological point of view. So it's all confounding. And I'd say in the world of boxing, we're doing everything we can based on the current literature. And then equally, you have to match it with the performance of the athlete and how good they are to recover.
Do you have a set of guidelines that the boxing authorities will set out for you guys, or do you follow a SCAT protocol, or, you know, so and who makes the judgment? Is that judgment made by medical personnel, by the referee, by the coach? Is there discussion around that? Very interesting topic.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, obviously, you have the Olympic side of things, and then you have the professional side of things. So the Olympic side of things, the ringside doctor, together with the referee, are probably your strongest bodies. So, you know, obviously, as the person in the corner, you can basically chuck in the towel. So obviously, if you see that your boxer is basically, you know, using the boxing phrase, getting a beating, or you're a bit concerned and you think the referee hasn't done anything, then you can ask the referee to stop the bout and usually chuck in the towel. In professional bouts, so like the ones you have seen, you know, the big ones with AJ, you can't chuck in towels. That doesn't happen. What you do is you alert. So you've got somebody that is in your corner, which is part of the neutral committee, which you alert them. And literally, you can tell them if you want to stop the bout themselves. Inside the ring, the referee, obviously, who's trained to obviously recognize certain things. Same as in football, is it? You know, the referee has certain level of expertise where they can, you know, either call in the medic straight away. In this case, they can stop a bout. So, you know, if they see that something is happening, they can stop it. And what you can see is the big controversies, especially in big fights and boxing. Has a referee stopped the bout too early? Has a referee stopped the bout too late? And what you always want is to stop it early. If you think about the first Ruiz fight, you know, the jury's out on that, because when he stopped it, some people may have thought he might have continued. Others might have thought, you know what, he's been given the count four times. Is there was a safe thing to do? And so, you know, at least history states that he recovered well after the bout. And then in the second fight, everything went well, tactics went well, and then he won it. So, you know, kudos to a referee, because in there, they have a massive amount of responsibility. But the corner equally has a big amount of responsibility, because the discussions that are happening there in between rounds are literally to ensure that we are happy with how the round is proceeding, obviously.
So there have been big changes in football, but regarding concussion management.
Yes.
And what I mean by that is that before you would have to ask the permission of the referee to enter the field of play to assess a player.
Yes.
Now there has been changes in the fact that if it's a head injury, you can go on the field of play without permission of the referee. So there's been changes there. And so what you would say to the refs, look, it's a head injury. And then so that the game has changed to kind of acknowledge the seriousness of, you know, the potential sequelae from a serious head injury. What have the has there been any changes in boxing with regards to recognition of a concussion, and then with regards to actually, you know, has there been any change in protocol? Do all boxing teams have to follow the same protocol?
I'll tell you what, the first thing I'd say is, like, as you know, when you are entering, the first thing you do is assess the danger. You tell me if you want to jump into a ring while they're still fighting. That's the first thing. No, but, you know, on a serious note, the rules, both within the professional and within the Olympic, are continuously changing, because as research keeps changing, as more information comes, as we find the best way of improving the sport. So if you think about one of the big controversies in Olympic boxing, the head guards for the male boxers was removed in the last cycle. So, you know, the male boxers in 2012, if you think about Anthony Joshua, for example, he had a head guard on. Whereas if you think about, you know, in this last cycle particularly, we had no head guards on. But as a result of that, we probably had an increase in cuts, so facial injuries, which obviously we had to mitigate with the right strategies. But interestingly, obviously, it helps to mitigate concussion, because one of the big considerations was that rotational force that was happening. And they did some studies, they looked into it, and they realized that taking off the head guard is probably the best way to approach it. And so at the moment, the belief is still that that was the right approach, by removing the head guards. So that's a good example to show that in the Olympic boxing, it is progressive and they continue. Equally, in the professional world, again, you know, it's a continued consideration. So, you know, the sort of gloves you're wearing, the protection. So one of the things you have to remember also is that when they are checking the gloves, you know, every team will come with 3 or 4 different gloves, which then have to be checked, assessed, like the day before, everything is really checked on. And what you don't want is for somebody to be wearing gloves which are like mittens, because you don't want the other boxer to get hurt. You know, although it's all bravado on front, I don't think there is really anybody out there who wants their opposite boxer to get really hurt. You know, it's one thing knocking them down and feeling like, you know, you've done the job. It's another thing sending them to hospital with a serious injury, and nobody wants that. So the reality is, all the professional bodies out there, you know, whether it's WA, WBC, and so on and so forth, they take it quite seriously. And the rules and regulations are explained not only the day before, but they're explained even before going in the ring. They'll tell them exactly what's going to happen. They'll tell them what the referee is going to do. You know, if I say stop, you stop. I tell you to listen, you listen. So, you know, they're quite strict when they're telling the boxer. They want them to understand that, you know, we want to look after you, but we want to look after the other guy too. So it's, I think, you know, beyond concussion as just a topic, I think generally just the total health of the person, they want to make sure that it's safe. And he probably has, that's why I went alluded to some referees sometimes, the public eye thinks, oh no, he went in too early, look, he stopped the referee. But you don't know what the referee knows, you don't know what he sees. You know, he's closer than anybody else. You don't know what he's seen in the previous rounds, maybe, like if the guy was really fatigued or seemed a bit off. So, you know, but equally, it's a balance, is it? Do you stop it too early? Do you stop it too late? And as I said, it's a science and art. They have to come together.
I think it's probably counterintuitive what I'm about to say here, but I would imagine the incidence of concussion is low in boxing. Number one, you're going to take a lot of mitigated strategies when you're in training. So you're not going to expose a boxer to a lot of headshots if they haven't got a head guard on in training. Or you'll set up the environment that it's, you know, sparring is under, you know, there are some restrictions with regards to sparring. And then, you know, with regards to competition isn't as often as people might think. And then these guys are getting, they're getting accustomed, they're getting acclimated to getting hit in the head in a lot of ways. So they've got strategies where they'll tuck their chin, where they've, so the question is, My guess is it's concussion is not as big an issue as people might think. But what is the prevalence of concussion in boxing?
You know what? It's actually low when you compare it to sports like rugby and football.
Yeah.
Because you hit it on the nail. First of all, there is the exposure and the right level of training. Like, there's no coach in the world which would allow a boxer to get concussed in every single session. It'd be counterintuitive, is it? It means that they can't train, really, if you're doing it properly. And eventually the boxer will just won't be able to train. The other thing which any coach will tell you, if you do that to a boxer, you make them lose the flavor of the sport. Because if you are getting concussed, basically you're getting a beating also, if you see what I mean. You know, it's a bit counterintuitive. Now, I don't mean that if you get concussed, you're getting a beating all the time. But in training, if it's happening all the time, it means that something isn't good. Your defense isn't right. Your level of preparation isn't good. Your physical general fitness isn't good. You know, we know these days that studies indicate that having a good level of general strength, neck strength, and then also preparatory anticipation. So it's all about the proprioception, the reflexes. And so there's a lot that goes into a boxing preparation, especially at that weight, you know, heavyweight, like AJ, if you think about it, to ensure we try and mitigate it. And any sparring session which these guys do, there's always a physio present. There's always a medical person present. Why? Because we are there just in case anything happens, you know, as you would have hopefully in training scenarios anyway in football, but also is to have that eye that when you're speaking with the coach, you can sort of speak about things, and if anything happens, they'll speak to you and you can, you know, cross-reference around that. So no, I'd say that the prevalence of concussion isn't as high as when you compare it to other sports. You know, I look at sports like rugby and football sometimes and I think, like, you know what, I'm glad I work in boxing because it's more controlled. You know, you don't have those, you know, the only way you can get really, like, let's use the word sparked out, just to move from concussion, just to make it more a bit thematic. The only way to get sparked out is to be hit by something that you weren't waiting for, okay? Now, usually that happens because you've not seen it. You've not seen the hit coming. Now, in boxers, and especially that's one of the reasons they remove the head guards, is to have that lateral vision. So even though you get hit and maybe you get wobbled a bit, so, you know, in reality, you could say, yeah, you probably were concussed a little bit because you were a bit ataxic, but you were prepared for it, you could brace for it. Whereas in football and rugby sometimes, they get whacked from the side by a defender or by, you know, in the scrum. They don't realize, and then they're on the ground. They don't even know what's happened. They're out. So that's what I mean. There's a different form of probably anticipation that happens in a boxer and the type of training they do compared possibly with other sports.
It's boxing is a bit Darwinian, and it's a bit natural selection. So, and what I mean by that is that the only way you're getting in the boxing ring in competition is because you are meant to be there. You are the survival of the fittest. You know, you've gone up through the ranks with regards to being a schoolboy boxer, and you've done a bit. You were good at this. You were able to accept some forces. You were able to give out some forces. You're acclimated to this. And you know, if you weren't, you'd probably give up at the age of 15, at 16, because, as you say yourself, you probably got a beating. So I like there's a lot of things that kind of go into the mix to kind of go, all right, well, actually, I don't think that concussion is such, I could be completely wrong, an issue in boxing as it would be in rugby, as it would be in the NFL, as it would be more so now in soccer, because you know, maybe heading a ball, guys' technique isn't great with it and so on and so forth. And maybe some guys are, you know, some positions being a centre-back, you know, and heading the ball in League Two is a little bit different to playing for Barcelona or for Man City and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. Head, like, I would imagine cuts, you know, is that your bread and butter?
You know what? Actually, my bread and butter is hands and wrists. That's probably where we get the prevalence of injuries. But obviously, you get facial injuries. And to be fair, we've done a fantastic job. We've done actually some studies within boxing to look at right ways of doing things. And I remember I've actually spoken with different sports around some of the things that they can do if they get a cut, you know, to try and keep somebody in training and even if they're competing closer. But now I think hands and wrist really have always been our bread and butter, definitely what I've seen in the last decade.
Can I come back to cuts, right?
Yes. But, yes. Okay,
because in football, right, it's it's a little bit different, so it's time crunch. But when we get a blood injury that doesn't, let's say that the player is going to return to the field of play, right? Imminently. Yes. And, you know, you're looking at strategies. So it's not a catastrophic bleed. Let's say it's a nosebleed.
Yeah.
But the player can't return to the field of play until the nosebleed is sorted. Basically, there can't be any blood on the shirt. He's got to have a new shirt. The bleeding has got to stop. You know, do you have, you know, we have particular strategies. So mine is my stopwatch goes on the moment. So I've already queued up the players, right? So if a lad goes down with a nosebleed, obviously I'm going to do a concussion assessment and so on and so forth. As long as he's not concussed, that buys me a little bit of time. And the magic time for me is, you know, between 4 and 6 minutes. So I'm going to do a full, you know, A to E assessment. I'm going to do a concussion assessment. The player knows that he gets a chance to blow his nose once. He's going to help me. I'm going, you know, as in that whole time, I'm holding off the referee. We're going to walk over slowly. The kit man knows what I'm doing as well, because we want the blood to coagulate, the nosebleed to stop, and giving him enough time to get back on the field of play. Now, I have a little bit more time there, but I guess, do you guys have strategies to stop bleeds?
Well, in the corner, you only have 1 minute, so excuse the language, you bloody hell should have a good strategy. Yeah. Otherwise, when they go out, they're all bleeding. I mean, in the last fight, he had a bit of a bleed in the second round, and the rules are that only one person can be on the canvas.
Okay.
So AJ had a bit of a bleed on the left eye, and because obviously in the corner we speak like, you know, any good team in the corner, like a pit stop really. So Rob McCracken, as the head coach, called me out. I jumped in. I did the job for what it was. Luckily, it wasn't a big cut. You know, it wasn't a laceration. Really, it was a small cut, and we sorted it out. So by the time he went in, it was forgotten. Some people still say, "Well, was it really a cut?" They say, "Yeah, it was a cut. We just did the right thing on the time." Now in boxing, you're allowed to use adrenaline. So, you know, that's, as you know, it's a vasoconstrictor. But there are some good products in the world, not just the world of boxing, in the general things, which maybe even use less substances like those. Like, so, you know, so Quick Aid, for example, is a clot that has certain properties on it to be able to stem the bleeding, and literally all it is natural agents that you can literally put on the area and help to stop. So again, it's probably still taking its time, because this is a natural hemostatic agent, and adrenaline, or, you know, epinephrine, which is 1 in 1,000, which is sort of the known drug used by Tatman and allowed, you know, it's a legal drug. I think there's probably still a bit of time for people to be comfortable to be using one versus the other. And again, like anything else, we still don't know whether if you use one with the other, whether actually one will counteract the other one. So I suppose is the type of cut you get, whether it's over the eye, whether it's inside the nose, which one are you comfortable using. But a cut man, what we're really good at is if you get a cut, you run it straight away, like it's the first thing you do. And so one hand is almost redundant. It's literally causing compression, which, as you know, Johnny, is probably the best thing, and then maybe have some product on it. So for the whole, I'd say if you've got a minute, probably you've jumped in the ring, hopefully you're Spider-Man, you've done it in 5 seconds. You've held the thing on for about 45 seconds to 50 seconds, and then you've finished off. With the other hand, you're assessing everything else and looking for, you know, anything serious. How's the face? We put a bit more Vaseline on the face again to create a barrier. So literally, it's like having 8 hands. You know, somebody
how,
once
told, how effective is Vaseline?
Well, Vaseline. So again, that's a bit of the misconception. Vaseline, all it is, it's a barrier to create sliding. Okay, it does not change anything to the permeability of the skin. There are certain products out there which are quite useful to create better permeability of the skin, which are the things you probably need to apply at the beginning of the day, hours before, maybe regularly, you know, like normal creams that people use. Education of how you wash your face, hydration, you know, are you hydrated well on the day? So, you know, skin protection, and, you know, probably the women out there probably know even better than us men. Skin protection is a big thing, how to have better elasticity. And so we have done a big campaign in the boxing world, especially with RGB boxes, to educate them how to have better skin quality. Because obviously, you know, if I use a very, you know, non-technical term, if your skin is dry, it's more likely to tear. It's like a stick, is it? If it's dry, it will break easier than being like a fresh stick.
So are you actually the cuts man now?
Well, for the last two fights, for the last two fights I was. Like anything else, you know, everything comes and goes with the season. I think the team felt like, with my expertise, having worked with cuts for so many years in GB boxing, my expertise with physio, and my knowledge, my medical knowledge, that I'd be more sort of appropriate to go in there and support the team. So I did that for the last two fights. Like anything else, I don't know whether I'll do the next one or not. You know, it's not an ego thing for me. If they want me to do it, I know I can do the job, as long as I am fit to do the job like anybody else, then I'll go in and do it. The other thing is, I know AJ, so one of the things you have to remember is, same as you do in football, you'll do moulages and do preparations before you get to the actual game. We will do the same even with boxing. So the last sparring sessions particularly, we'll try and do it a bit more like a bit of a moulage, where, you know, like, who's simple things, even like who brings up the ice, who passes the bucket, you know, sounds pedantic, but it has to work like an oiled machine.
Yeah. So I'm guessing, you know, I could be wrong. You're probably the first physio to be a cutsman in professional boxing.
I wouldn't say I'm the first physio, because I know of some people that have who have been over there. I'm probably one of those, maybe being more known as the physio before then jumping in onto cutsmen. So there's a few people out there who probably were cutsmen, maybe have had physio background in the very beginning and then stopped practicing in. You know how it is. Sometimes people start doing physio and then they've jumped into doing more of the cutsmen, but that's been like many years ago. But in the modern era, I say yes, there's not a lot of physios who then also dub as a cutsman. And the reason being is because the cutsman circle, I wouldn't say it's closed, but it's a bit harder than... So in rugby and football, if you're a physio to be pitch side, it's not very hard, because all you need to be is employed with the sport or know certain people and so on and so forth. It's a bit more restrictive in the cutsman's world, and especially, you know, if people have been working for a long time, they know, oh, you know, he's better. So, like, if you're working with Manchester United, you're not going to say, I'm going to bring the physio from Manchester City because he's a better pitch side physio. It doesn't happen, is it? Whereas in boxing, it sort of happens in a way, because a cutman is almost a bit neutral and they can work with different boxers. Obviously, for me, you know, AJ is like, you know, is like a family thing, because I've got my performance director, who's the head coach. I've got lots of the team. Some of them work with GB Boxing. Some of them work with theirs. So it's harder for me to just say, yeah, I'm going to start working as a cutsman with everybody. I think it's just the privilege of doing both the physio stuff and the cutsman together, and just loving the experience, really. You know, it's just one of the things to say, like, you know what, I've been in the corner of two world championship bouts fantastic.
Now, you and I have collaborated in a project with regards to writing a comprehensive book on sporting injuries and physiology for Elsevier, which is going to be published over the next couple of months. And I read your chapter on wrist and hand injuries in boxing, and I thought it was phenomenal. Would you tell, for the listeners, what's the most prevalent injury that you would see, how you would manage it briefly, and maybe if it's time loss, and, you know, some of the stuff that maybe they could do from a rehab point of view?
Oh, yeah, no, brilliant. I mean, it's interesting with the hands and wrists, because when I joined boxing, I never thought that, you know, the hands and wrists would have become almost a bit of my world. And I say that just because beyond boxing, even within the Olympic and Paralympic community, and even in professional sports like rugby and others, I've ended up providing lots of expertise around the hands and wrists, because obviously now I've been, you know, 11 years working in boxing, and the things you learn there have extrapolated into sports and even in the general public. But, you know, specific to the question you asked, in boxing, you get three main injuries, really. You've got knuckles, you've got the back of the hand, you've got the thumbs. Predominantly, they're traumatic. You do get some overuse-type injuries, you know, where they build up over time, but usually that's one-off traumatic. And one of the things that I've learned from the very beginning is that, you know, you can actually do stuff to mitigate the injuries because it's traumatic. So I'm one of those geeks that likes biomechanics. I like to look at the mechanics. How does the injury happen? You know, what's causing it? Try and learn. And, you know, I did a lot of that in the period I've been in boxing. And one of the things that we've came up with over the years is definitely, apart from the strengthening techniques, which again have been fantastic in the way we've approached both, I'd say, prehabilitation, but also rehabilitation. I think, you know, and as we go along, we're trying to keep, you know, divulging this information. But the other big piece for me has been the bandaging. Like, bandaging is like an art. But, you know, like over the years, one of the things that I've loved doing is creating bandaging techniques linked to the type of injuries and helping boxers obviously reduce the incidence, or even when they had symptoms, allow them to compete, because then you're working against the mechanics that's happening. On top of that, you know, not to be boring, I'm actually doing a PhD on wrist biomechanics in boxing.
Right. Okay.
I know.
Ian, just a quick one from me, mate. I know you were meant to be in Dubai right now, I think, or you were. Anyway. And you were going to do a seminar. And
yes.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned something called kinetic chain. Can you explain what that is, please?
Oh, yes. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, sometimes I forget myself. Like, obviously, I'm sure, like a lot of people out there, like, we're probably geared up to do all your face-to-face teaching and had all the courses in line and was, you know, showing them on social media, I'm going to be there and there and there. And suddenly, obviously, this COVID hit. And then, you know, it just changes perspective of life, is it? Absolutely. It just made you realize. But no, with the kinetic chain, it's quite simple. You know, if you are in football, all you treat and think about is the lower limbs, and you forget that you have the rest of the body. And I'm trying to instigate a bit, Johnny, here. But when you're working in boxing and you've got a hand and wrist injury, you do have to think about the rest of the body. Lots of studies, like old studies, all the way back to like 1995 by a chap called Kibler, and all the way till today, we keep using those studies that were done in tennis and newer studies. The force you create is about 50% from your trunk and hip region, and then starts breaking down into, like, say, 20 in your shoulder, 15 in your elbow, 10 in your hand and wrist. So when you're creating the force, it starts breaking down. Now, in a boxer, the studies have shown at an elite level, if you're hitting with your backhand, you know, your strongest punch, you're probably hitting around 5,000 newtons. Now, that might mean nothing to anybody, but basically, if you get a mallet, which probably weighs about, you know, 6 to 10 kilograms, and hit somebody at the speed of about, say, 40 kilometers an hour, that's probably what it means. So you're probably going to kill somebody. Let's put it this way. So when we say using the kinetic chain, it means considering what's happening in the rest of the body. So for me, what that means is if we're getting injuries which are overuse or they keep coming back, we call them repetitive. You know, you treat an injury, keeps coming back, a bit like a spider's web, is it? You clean it, it keeps coming back, you clean it, it keeps coming back. You have to consider what's happening at the trunk, what's happening at the hips, what's happening at the feet. You know, do they have the right strength, endurance, flexibility? Do they have the right technique? You know, and that's where sometimes you can go a bit head-to-head with the coach. But, you know, if you have the right technology to show technique, if you have a coach that can listen to you, and luckily, you know, the coaches we have at GB Boxing and even with AJ, you know, we have these discussions around techniques and other bits and bobs. It helps because, you know, a wrist injury doesn't mean that it's happening at the wrist. That's the conundrum. A wrist injury could be happening because it's occurring due to a problem somewhere else.
And I guess injury prevention is key for you guys. And I remember reading somewhere you said that shin splints are uncommon in boxing training. And you mentioned the word deconditioned. Now, do you think there's going to be a lot of deconditioned boxers coming back after this whole COVID situation?
Yeah, so the way to see it is, so we do stats, and especially every 4 months, we do a bit of an analysis, which we look at things. But what we recognized that, especially our female population, compared with the male population, are more likely to get lower limb injuries. Probably the ratio is like 3:1 from an injury point of view. And probably one of the reasons is because the male population, they have a longer history of boxing type training, including running, whereas the female population, as you know, the women only joined the Olympic boxing in 2012. So it's a younger sport. You know, if you had to consider it male versus women, it's a younger sport. Now, if you use that same ideology of time, exposure, and especially if you look at what's being discussed in the wider literature, all the forums, all the discussions, it's all about chronic exposure. How much can you expose them before then bringing somebody in and doing something drastic? So it's quite simple, really, what we have done. We've been in lockdown for the last 11 weeks. And the boxers haven't just been sitting on their ass. They've actually been having weekly programs, including S&C, running, boxing training. The running to get the exposure of the ground, obviously, and the boxing to get the exposure in the upper limb, because equally you can get those overuse injuries or, you know, suddenly you're exposed more to one-off traumatic. Now, we've got 12 boxers actually starting back in Sheffield next week, you know, which is our Olympic training facility. We've got a group of coaches on the ground, and we've got very minimal support staff. So, you know, we're starting with the minimal amount from a government guidelines risk illness point of view. But from an injury prevention, we're quite comfortable because we've done so much prescription over this period. We even monitor them daily using a wellness monitoring. So, you know, we send them information, which they fill in, you know, their mood, their motivation, have they slept well, do they have any injury, do they have any illness, you know, all those things. We've been tracking them over this period, that we feel comfortable that next week it's not going to be any different than any other week. Plus, again, you know, we speak to our coaches who are very sensible, and actually they're going to do a very easy reintroduction. It's not about, you know, killing the boxers. It's about getting them in, making them comfortable. At the end of the day, you know, it's making them feel that they are people returning to the sport rather than just thinking of them as just boxers.
Oh, absolutely. And I guess you being a physio, you're going to have to kind of humanize them as well. And by that, I mean they're constantly in the limelight. You know, the cameras everywhere, fans, the adulation, they kind of feel like gods, don't they? And then they suffer a loss, a big loss at that. How do you keep them motivated? I guess they have someone there to talk to from a mental health perspective.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the biggest things in the media has obviously been mental health. But we have had sports psychology and performance lifestyle, particularly with us, for numbers of years. And what they do is they help us, they guide us with the information. So, you know, as the physio, you're the one treating them on the table, sometimes on your own. If you're in the changing rooms and you're helping them cool down after they've lost the fight, and maybe you're the only one in there, or sometimes you're even preparing them for a fight, there's a lot of those strategies. But especially in this period, you know, a lot of the prescription we've been providing is to make sure that they are good in themselves. So it wasn't so much about them doing, you know, doing the run or doing the S&C or doing the boxing. You know, let's be honest, that's trivial in the grand scheme of things. For us, is making sure that everybody was good. So my job, especially speaking with these great professionals, which are your psychologist, performance, lifestyle, and the rest of the wider team, is making sure that, you know, we leave no stone left unturned. You know, how is so-and-so? How is he feeling? You know, we've heard that, you know, his home situation isn't so good. What can we do for him? And those were a lot of the conversations happening to ensure that everybody really was in a good state. And again, it's not just the boxers. It's the support team. It's the coaches. It's the senior management team in a sport. You know, you talked about the managers, the CEOs. You know, this period of not being able to be on the ground in your training facility can take a toll on anybody. So it's important that you come together as one.
Brilliant. Cheers, mate.
Thank you.
Dinry?
You know, I got listening intently. No, it's been brilliant. Very interesting. Thank you once again, Ian. One thing, Ian, I just wondered, there's a guy who lives locally up here who is being involved with Team GB. I'm just wondering if you've crossed paths with him in your time with them, a guy called Graham Alderson.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know Graham, man.
Yeah, Graham obviously was in the army, and he looks after our development boxes. So he's like the lead coach for like your development boxers, the next generation coming up that will go then into some of them might go straight up to podium even before next year and maybe be part of this coming Olympics. But really is the squad preparing for Paris for, you know, the next Olympic cycle. So obviously we were meant to be 2020, the next one 2024 for Paris. So no, Graham is a fantastic coach, engages a lot with the support team. He's been doing Zoom sessions with the boxers. He's been working with the performance analysis team. You know, they've been doing fantastic work, you know, which sometimes you don't even realize what goes behind the scenes. Like, you know, he's been asking the performance analysis team to put together videos of certain particular themes or certain particular styles of boxers, showing them to his own boxers and then making training around that. So, you know what? You know, kudos to everybody. Like, it's been busy behind the scenes, and Graham is one of those coaches who really embraces his role to, you know, support the boxers, and not just that. You know, if somebody has an injury, he wants to make sure that the boxer is doing well. He speaks to the physios. You know, if somebody needs to increase in strength, or there's a problem with some management around their nutrition, he'll speak to either the S&C or the nutritionist. So, you know, and like him, our senior coaches, you know, who have been around for donkey's years, you know, they've embraced the support team. I remember when I started in 2009, we were a handful of support staff, you know, like a bit like a garage band starting, really. And now we're about 15 practitioners working in boxing. So, you know, you can see how the sport has embraced it, and the collaboration between coaches and support staff is amazing.
Yeah, he's a good lad. We frequent the same watering hole I used to many years ago, and I taught him a few lessons on the five-a-side court. So I'm glad he's a better boxer than he is at football.
he's a great coach, and you know, I think we really love Sora because obviously, you know, he's that generation coming through, because obviously our main coaches, our senior coaches, you know, they're in their 60s. You know, bless them, they do the pads to the boxers, they go around the world everywhere, like they've been like from any part of the world, you know, every month to do lots of travel. So, you know, it all takes a toll eventually, you know, well, hopefully not, you know, you always imagine them as being Highlanders, like they'll never retire. But, you know, these are the coaches that eventually will have to allow people like Graham then to take over. So it's great to see somebody like Graham really enthusiastic about the program, really.
Cool. Thank you for your time, man. It's been really insightful. Really enjoyed the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you know what, Ben? When you said that there's a guy up here, I thought you were about to say that thinks he can take on AJ.
There's a lot of people who think that.
Yeah, yeah.
There'll be plenty of guys up here that will think that, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Especially after a few bottles of brown.
The only person who can take AJ is me, because I put him on his back most days of the week when I can.
Well, I'll tell you what. I've seen him outside Nando's in Finchley. I wouldn't like to take him on. In fact, I think sometimes he trains at Trent Park as well, which is around the corner from me. But yeah, he seems like a nice guy anyway. So yeah, Johnny.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
Fascinating podcast tonight. Ian, thank you so much for being so transparent on a lot of tricky questions, because, you know, we talked about concussion, we talked about cuts, we talked about hand and wrist injuries, we talked about, you know, stuff that, you know, returning to boxing. We talked about the COVID period. There was a huge amount covered with regards to tonight's podcast. So I know a huge amount of physios and people who just are in and around boxing, that they'll get a huge amount from tonight. I certainly did anyway. I learned loads. So thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. Phenomenal.
Thanks, Johnny. Thanks, Stelle. And Ben, thank you very much for having me tonight. Thank you, guys.
Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. And hopefully you can jump on with us again. It'll be great to talk to you once more. Before we let you go, would you like to plug anything, like any social media?
Obviously, like, everybody can find me on the usuals. I'm on LinkedIn or Twitter or Instagram. You know, my main ethos really is to try and educate where I can. So, you know, trying to tell people what I'm doing, try and showcase really the work we're doing, especially at GB Boxing, or even with the teaching I do, particularly around hands, wrist, and the rest of the upper limb. So, you know, whenever you want, guys, just follow me. Ask the questions, you know, I'm out here to be able to help wherever I can.
Fantastic, brilliant, appreciate your time, mate, thank you very much.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers. Right, gentlemen, Twitter handles before we wrap it up. Ben.
At Ben Dinnery.
Fantastic. Johnny.
At Johnny_Wilson5.
Great stuff. And are you going to do any more YouTube videos for us?
Yes, Nottingham Physio. I'm doing a masterclass on the ankle at the moment with a lot of guys out in Iceland. So that's where my time is spent online, obviously. I'm not out there in person, but I'm certainly out there in spirit. So, I'll be posting some stuff around assessment management of the ankle, especially for soccer players who are not professional footballers. So if you are with the Dog and Duck, like who I used to play with, on a Sunday or a Saturday, or you don't have that support, check out Nottingham Physio over the next few weeks. We'll be posting up some really cool stuff around ankle injury management.
Fantastic. And there seems to be a lot of positive feedback in regards to our podcast with Zlatko Vučković a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, that went down phenomenally. And then Zarko is going to get involved with our Francie McGroin. Yes, so he shall be writing in Francie McGroin Adventures in over the next few chapters. So that's going to be phenomenal. You'd never know. Francie might actually make his way up to Sheffield and have a chat with Ian Gatt at some stage.
There you go. That'd be exciting. Bring them out. So that's it for us for another week. Hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I'm sure you did. So we're on Twitter at Shoot the Fence. We have an Instagram page. So until next week, take care.
With
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.